Well, hello, and good evening, friends and neighbors, and welcome to the March 13th, 2021 installment of the Stories at Latitude 56, the radio edition. My name is Jack Finnegan. I'm delighted to be your host this evening and every month for this event, and I look very much forward to the day that we can reunite at the Creek Street Cabaret for the resumption of our in-person story slams. This production is coordinated between KRBD, where I'm broadcasting to you live this evening, and with the Ketchikan Area Arts and Humanities Council. And I have just raced to the station from the Ketchikan High School Auditorium, where I had the great fortune of having just the smallest bit of participation in the Ketchikan High School Musical Theater Club's production of Mary Poppins Jr. And if you know any of those students that were involved, they are due for some hearty congratulations. Such patient kids. Twice, in fact, their production was put off because of an uptick in COVID cases. And they were troopers, stuck it out, kept working on the show, and put on a couple of beautiful performances over the past couple of weekends. So I'm really excited to see a theater program happening there. And it also gave me cause to think about how important it is for us to spend that kind of time together. And as delighted as I am to be here at the radio station sharing your neighbor's stories with you, I do look so forward to that occasion when we will be able to sit together again and hear each other's stories. And to be very candid with you, I feel like the deeper we get into this future that we're creating, especially at this time when so much time has been spent either seeing each other online or from some distance, it just becomes more critically important that we do share space together and hear each other's stories, whether they're told in person or presented in the form of theater or poetry or paintings, gallery openings. I miss you all, and I look forward to seeing you again. But tonight I've got a few stories for you, and I have to tell you that it has been a matter of some very minor frustration for me to try to drum up the kind of stories that I know this town can tell. And it isn't because people aren't interested in telling stories. I know people are interested in hearing these stories. It's just always a bit of a bear trying to recruit people to participate in this and other programs. And I was remembering this week, as I was coordinating with some of the future storytellers that you will be hearing from this region, I was thinking back to some of the earliest days of the Story Slam. And I've talked about this in the program in the past. But there was one Wednesday in particular, the second year that I was involved with the program, just when the Story Slam was beginning to become our main focus. It was a beautiful Wednesday. This was before we had our home set up at the Creek Street Cabaret, and we were scrambling a little bit, using different spaces, whatever became available on different occasions. And on this particular beautiful Wednesday afternoon, and I think it was the month of June or July. It was definitely the summertime. It was the first break in the weather in a while. And I was concerned that nobody was going to want to come inside for anything. It was just too nice out. And to my suspicion, my suspicions were proven true. We had a couple of people show up, and Jeff Fitzwater was there from the Arts Council with me, and Jeff told a story, and I told a story, and we tried to convince one or two of our storytellers, or excuse me, our audience members to tell a story, and they all politely declined. It was a very short event. And I would like to avoid having short events like that. Within a year, the Story Slam was a bumpin' event, and I look forward to this program getting to that same level of demand where people are lining up to tell me stories. So if there's a story that you would like to share, really it can be on any topic. For the next couple of months, I'm particularly interested in hearing about how your views of this region have been shaped, perhaps by the work that you do, the work that you've done, the work that you would like to do. We'll talk more about that later. This evening, I've got three stories to share with you, and they're actually revisitations from previous radio editions of the Stories at Latitude 56 program, in part because the storytellers that I'm working with right now are still giving shape to their stories. But I think there's a real advantage to revisiting stories that we've already, perhaps you haven't heard these stories, perhaps you missed the programs they were part of in the past, but if you have heard them, it's really nice to revisit a story, maybe pick up details that you didn't catch the first time. I certainly have, as I've revisited these tales, and I'm going to say nothing further and let them get to it because they're really the reason that we are here. So, first story was a storyteller who participated in the very first radio edition. He's a man that I'm thrilled to have even a passing acquaintance with because his life and his stories are so rich and really truly profound, even if he calls them a little bit woo-woo.
So I guess it was probably like 78, I was working down at the Spruce Mill that used to be down right downtown Ketchikan, and we happened to be on strike. And, you know, it was kind of a bad time because I had just bought a little boat, a little Pacific skiff that it was just a beautiful little boat. It, you know, it rode the waves just like a little seabird, you know. And it had these really nice rolled gunnels, kind of picture that, you know, you had cupped hands all the way around the boat. So when you go over a wave, it would kind of claw the air and kind of let you down nice and easy, you know. And so I was kind of anxious to test it, you know, and I didn't really have enough money to buy a steering station. So I made this out of pulleys and an old pick handle, a stick. It's kind of like you'd run an airboat or an airplane. And so I sat right amidships, and I had this stick, and I'd push it one way or the other to turn the boat. So anyway, I was anxious to get to try it, and so my friend Kelly said, "Hey, being that we're down on strike, let's go to Thorn Bay." And I said, "Oh, okay, sure." Well, he'd never been there before, and neither had I, and so it was just this beautiful sunny day, and I decided, well, let's go. And I said, well, how come we're going? He says, well, I want to do some halibut fishing. And then I said, well, hey, you know, I was over there last year, and I know that those logs in the fishing in the river are full of lures. So I'm going to bring my wetsuit and harvest lures and sell them, you know, at discount, this and that. So anyway, we had a purpose. So off we went. And so we got out to Guard Island. Once again, this is just a beautiful sunny day. Must have been 70 degrees, you know, and we're sitting by Guard Island side by side, me and my little 15-footer, and he and his, like, he had an 18-foot, like a glass ply with a rag top or whatever, and he says, well, you think we ought to go? And I kind of hemmed and hawed, and back in those days, I didn't have a radio for a weather report, you know, and I think the weather report was quick glance up at the sky, you know. So anyway, we hemmed it hot, and the next thing you know, we both edged out into Clarence Strait, and before we know it, I mean, it was too late to turn back. Now, I've been around on boats, you know, for years and years, and, you know, I pretty good guess the seas, but I'll tell you what, if they weren't 20-footers, they were approaching 20-foot, and so there was no way we could turn around. And so, anyway, we're getting up in these freaking seas, and Kelly says, hey, you know, we're screaming over the wind. I say, hey, you know, I don't quite know where we're going. And I says, well, we got to go to Ship Island. It's the only place there's a little cove in there that I know of. And he says, well, I don't know where that is. So I tried to get him. I got up on the crest of this wave, and I'm surfing down trying to get close to him. Darn near went up into the back of his boat twice. But I finally got to the point where I could throw him the chart. I had the chart. And I said, I'll meet you at Ship Island. And so I did better to port. He did better to starboard. But as I left, I said, how are you doing? And he says, well, I got so much water in the boat that as I go down into the trough, it's all running to the bow. And when I go up, it's all running to the stern. And I says, if you start sinking, just head into shore and keep on running, get up in the woods, and I'll try and find you. And he said, okay. So anyway, I don't know how long we battled this thing, but, you know, it was fairly late in the evening when I got to Ship Island, and there was nobody there. So I thought, oh, man. So, but there was a little troller tucked in a cove there, what cove there is, and he had two anchors out over a ledge and shorelines and all this and that. So I pulled up next to him. I said, hey, have you seen my friend? And, you know, pardon the, you know, the accent, but it was, what you doing out there, you dumb son of a gun? You know, she's blowing 70, don't you? And, you know, and so it was a Norwegian fellow with these two grandkids from Petersburg. And there's something about being scolded by an old seaworthy Norwegian that just makes you kind of, you know, want to shrink up. So anyway, he said, oh, come on board. And then they fed me, and I spent a sleepless night on the forecastle floor. Well, it was summertime, so it was light at, you know, four in the morning or something. And so I said, I got to get up. I got to go look for my friend Kelly. So off I went. Well, a little while later, I see that his two grandsons had launched their boat, and they were kind of going along beside me there. Well, you know, the gunnels, these rolled gunnels that help you, you know, when you're going with it to kind of claw the air and soften your blow, when you're going against it, they kind of, you know, the air kind of catches. And so anyway, twice I went up over the top of a wave, and it turned me like I pirouetted in the air and landed in the other direction. And so anyway, I thought, oh man, it's pretty hairy. And I looked out, and their boat was gone. The two grandkids, they were gone. So anyway, I persevered and finally got to where it calmed down a little bit. And so I'm going along slow, following the beach. And I thought, well, if Kelly's in the woods, I need to call him down so I can, you know, find him. So I pulled out my pistol, my little bear pistol, and started shooting at intervals. And so I'm shooting up in the air, and I look down, and here's all these dull porpoise. And the thing is they're going around and around and around the boat. And so I think, well, that's cool, but I'm worried about Kelly, you know, that, you know, I didn't know if I was going to, you know, what that was going to be. So anyway, I proceed down the beach for at least 45 minutes to an hour, popping off rounds every now and then. And his porpoise continued to go around and around and around the boat. And so, you know, I was getting low on ammo, and I was thinking, God, this is weird that they're staying around even though I'm popping off a pistol. And I happened to look over my shoulder, and here comes a Coast Guard cutter. And I see one of the crew members out on the stern deck there, and they kind of edge up closer to me. And he's yelled over, he says, hey, are you looking for your friend? And I said, yeah. He says, he's in Thorn Bay. And I said, cool. And bam, the porpoise were gone. Okay, well, that's cool. So I turned the boat, and the Coast Guarder, you know, just went on its way. I headed toward Tolstoy Point, which is just outside of Thorn Bay. And a little while later, the porpoise came back, and they were going with me this time, like they usually do. You know, they just kind of cruise on your bow wake and all this and that. So anyway, after a while, they peeled off, and I got to Tolstoy Point and pulled into Thorn Bay, docked the boat, and went up, and Kelly was cooking breakfast, and he had a little trailer over there. And, you know, there was a little whiskey. he was doing bacon and eggs. Now, I don't really drink, but I had a couple of shots of whiskey, and I said, Kelly, what's going on? I says, you know, you're supposed to meet me at Ship Island. And he said, you know, I was there. And he says, the weirdest thing, he said, there were all these porpoise came up, and they went around and around and around the boat. And he said, I was just really indecisive. He said, I didn't know if you were going to just keep on going or if I should stay there or what, but just something felt like I should just, you know, go on to Tolstoy Point. And he said, you know, those porpoise, once they stopped going around and I started going forward, they stayed with me almost all the way to Tolstoy Point. And I said, wow, that's interesting. And I told him my story, and we just went on and had breakfast, and I harvested the lures and everything else. Well, you know, kind of on the borderline of woo-woo, but what, you know, I kind of dismissed it, you know. But then about 2 years later, I had bought a 35-foot boat, and I was going to Thorn Bay again, and it was picking up. And I thought, oh, man, if I could just see a doll's porpoise, I'd feel more confident. I'd feel like I'd be okay. And I swear, you know, nobody was there. I mean, I can substantiate this story with Kelly, but there was nobody there with me. But as I was thinking that, I looked down from the wheelhouse, out of my wheelhouse window, and there was a dull porpoise on its side looking up at me. And it was like we had this moment, you know. And It did kind of some chills, you know. I was a little, you know, I kind of started believing in the woo-woo, and headed off to Tolstoy. That was it, you know. But every once in a while, people ask me if I have a animal totem or something like that. Well, I don't know how you get one, but if it has anything to do with kind of a spiritual connection, I guess I'm going to have to pick Dol Porpoise. And, you know, I don't really have an amulet, but maybe I should kind of start wearing one. All right. That's the story.
And, gosh, what a story. Every time I hear this tale, and I've heard it a few times now, I am astonished by one element or aspect of it or another. And in listening to it again this evening, my mind keeps going back to... This was Rich Stage, by the way. I don't believe that I mentioned his name at the top of the story. And the casual nature with which Rich relates this tale is part of what amazes me about it. The fact that he was in seas that he estimated at 20 feet or so in a skiff with a buddy. And my mind goes to that exchange when they recognized how bad the conditions were, the nature of their predicament, and they're trying to communicate with each other. And somehow, I know Rich said he nearly ran up against Kelly's boat, managed to avoid doing that. I think it nearly happened a few times. But the fact that he is driving this, he is piloting this skiff with a series of pulleys and a pick handle that he assembled in the nature of, say, an airplane stick, is already incredible. But the fact that they're in these high seas, they're having this conversation, and Rich somehow manages to throw a chart from one boat to another while they're underway in that weather is just astonishing to me. And the fact that they managed to reunite. But to Rich's closing comments about not being sure how you get a so-called spirit animal, so to speak. Well, Rich, I think you're probably better situated than most in telling us exactly how to get such a relationship established. And I do know that any of us who spend any time in the out-of-doors here have constant occasion to be amazed at the diversity of life that we encounter, the different ways that people live here, and all of the animals that make this place their home. And there is so much that we learn from those animals about the way that this place functions. And it's a pretty humbling reminder that for all that we think that we know and all that we think that we have access to, there are mysteries abounding around us at all times, and these animals see things that we will never understand. And those occasions when we get to draw some lesson from them, I think, is hugely important. Now, this next storyteller also has shared a story with us in the past. This is a revisitation of one of her tales, and she is one of the regular performers at our Story Slam when we have those in person. And I'm going to turn the microphone over now to Miss Hannah Bales.
My relationship with water is complicated. First, I couldn't really swim, like, I'm not going to die in the deep end kind of swim, till I was about 12. I still don't know how to jump into the water without plugging my nose. But I can swim underwater for a total of 10 seconds, which is impressive, I know. Then we'll factor in that time that I was 6 and left on an island in the middle of a lake for around 2 hours because the adults had to swim out extra life jackets to the rest of the party when the jet ski broke down. It's a complicated story, but they just didn't make it back for a while. But I'd have to say, Sunday school was really the thing that put the nail in the coffin, sealing me inside with the anxiety of being swallowed whole by a whale, all because biblical Jonah didn't have the courage to spiritually colonize the city of Nineveh. Anyways, cut to this summer, 2020, and Joey and I are taking 3 weeks to play around on Tan, meaning sea lion, in Tlingit, now known as Prince of Wales Island. And I tell myself, well, it's not that kind of island of whales, but I know that they're out there. We reserve our cabins, and Joey builds a canoe rack for the top of my Subaru, which is proof, by the way, that I at least wish I was more outdoorsy. Now, there is something about Alaska that makes me so desperately want to shed these old lower 48 fears and embrace nature with a healthy respect for its power. I want to go for a midnight dip in the bioluminescence or jump off the dock on a hot 68-degree day. I want to canoe around lakes and spot beaver pups. It's just not that easy for me. Our first adventure was to Sarkar Lake, which is supposed to be a quick 45-minute canoe paddle to the cabin. The cabin that's located somewhere in this labyrinth of islands, designed to be nature's version of a house of mirrors. But it's no problem. We have a GPS with the cabin already pinned. Thank you, Joey. So, we get loaded up, ready to take off. And I think, has my dog ever been in a canoe before? I can say for certain this is my first time in a canoe with my dog. Well, I'm in front, so really that's Joey's problem. And he's responsible for keeping Arlo as still as a statue because, so help me God, if this canoe wobbles, nothing will actually happen. But my heart will get all the cardio needed for a week without the paddling. And now that we're on our way, I'm discovering I don't really know how to use a GPS. With my cortisol levels, the highest that they have ever been, we make it to the cabin. Just a mere hour and a half from our launch. Also, I really hate canoeing with my dog. What could possibly be so interesting in the water that you feel the need to go from one side of the canoe to the other to the actually, you know what? Don't tell me. And just sit. The next morning, we paddle back. And I'm a bit more confident. Or just happy that I don't have to canoe again for a few days. Sarkar Lake Cabin was a 10 out of 10. My confidence in a canoe, a solid 4 out of 10. And that's progress. A few days later, we head off to Sweetwater Lake. This is supposed to be a much shorter paddle. This cabin is not marked on the GPS, however, because neither Joey or I have ever been here. So using some old printout map, we have to make a guess of where our launch point is in relation to the cabin. Things are different on Sweetwater Lake. It's really open. And it's really, really windy. Like, there are waves lapping onto the shore. And I swear I see whitecaps out there. We're so close to the coast that there are seagulls flying overhead. And if it weren't for those lily pads, you could not convince me there wasn't a whale just waiting for me out there. It's a short paddle. It's a short paddle. I repeat over and over to myself. I'm simply not having a good time. The wind is in my face. Carrying sprays of water into my face. The canoe is slapping the water. The waves, which you may hear Joey call ripples, were hitting us sideways as we paddle along the shore. I want to be close to the shore, but I know that a great way to flip a canoe is to hit one of those downed trees. So further away from the shore, I am miserable, and I think my life jacket is getting tighter. It's definitely getting tighter, and these waves are definitely starting to pick up. Does that water over there look like it's boiling? I have enough. Sure, I yell. Through the storm, we beeline to the closest gravelly patch I know that I can stand on. The chocolate lilies are laughing at me. I can hear them. This isn't working. And shouldn't we have made it to the cabin by now? We've been paddling for a while. Joey sits there in the canoe. I can only assume questioning every choice he has made in life to lead him to this moment. He pulls out the map again and his GPS. I think we went the wrong way. I look out at the sea. Captain Ahab would have feared. And I see only one option. Get back in the canoe. I thought by this point I'm numb. I'm too tired to care if I live or die. So I climb in and we push off. It was worse this direction. I tried to decide if this is the horror version of Universal Studios 4D Adventures or if this is reality. Fully convinced that it's both. After the front of the canoe slapped the water, covering my face in what Gwyneth Paltrow would pay $300 an ounce for, I was done. My tears blending in. I just couldn't handle it any longer. Sure, I yell once again. I climb out of the canoe, strip off my life jacket, and begin walking in the direction of our launch point. I choose to temporarily ignore my fear of spiders as I walk through tree limbs, bushes, and under fallen logs. After a while, I've finally calmed down enough to look to my right and I see Joey gently bobbing in the canoe as he paddles along the shore. It's silent. I'm all too aware of the different realities we both exist in. He wasn't in a raging sea, rather in a smooth swaying hammock on a sunny beach drinking a Mai Tai from a coconut shell. I'm really resenting the path that led me to my reality. After a 30-minute walk, we made it back to the launch point where I once again saw only one option, get back in the canoe. I did. And we paddled the correct direction, through a cove that was smooth as aged glass. Blue herons played on the shore. A mother loon led her babies on an evening swim, and the clouds gave way to thick rays of sunshine. The creators of Fantasia called and asked me to record a video they could use as a reference for their next dream sequence. 8 minutes from our launch point, we were gliding onto the shore in front of our cabin. As Joey began to collect wood for the fire, I snuck into the cabin, changed my underwear, and was ready to start anew. The next morning, the water was so calm you would have thought it was solid. Joey convinced me to paddle around a nearby island. I agreed, and I was actually really enjoying myself. The loons sang to us. We pointed out cool places to camp. We rounded the corner and the cabin was back in sight. And then I saw it. The water moved. Joey, what was that? A mass. A massive mass moved between us and the cabin. This is it. Dear God, this is it. The one and only sweet water whale. Death by whale. It's a seal, Joey whispered. Even worse, death by seal.
Death by seal. And, you know, if you're going to establish some sort of meaningful relationship with one of the animals in the wild here, I hope it's not at the cost of your own demise. What I do love about having these stories back to back alongside one another, though, is Hannah speaks very frankly about the novelty of this terrain for her in many respects, and having to come face to face with some of her personal concerns or worries or fears about how to be in this place and how to navigate this place. And something she says very early in this story about the area that she and Joey were paddling being nature's version of a house of mirrors is, I think, a really important observation, especially for anybody who is still acclimating in any way to whether it's the mountains we have here, the rainforest itself travels out on the water. And I can certainly think of a couple of occasions, at least in the 8 or so years that I've been here, where being pretty green, being new to this region, I had some really, really frightening moments of disorientation. One was much more controlled. It was my first summer up here. I was training to be a guide on the water, and my employers, who had spent the better part of my first week in town just acclimating me to the nature of boat operation itself, asked me to take one of the boats, go way out into the middle of Nichols Passage. This was on one of those really misty, foggy mornings in late April, you know, late spring, before the summer gets started, where the visibility is pretty limited. And they wanted me to just drive for a while and then find my way back to town. I didn't have GPS. I had a radio, but I was determined not to use it. And this was the first time I'd have been out on the water on my own without my my employer or a colleague to guide me back to safety if I got myself disoriented or lost. Well, I got out. I just drove for 40 minutes or so and parked out in the middle of Nichols Passage at a spot where I really couldn't see much of the shoreline and had to find my way back to town. So I kind of turned back in the direction from which I think I just came, and I'm looking at the shoreline, and it occurs to me that in the week or so that I've been here, I have been memorizing shorelines, or attempting to anyway, by virtue of the features that are actually in the intertidal zone. But it was high tide now. And all of those rocks, all of those features, all of those little shoals were now underwater. And for me, new to town, new to this region, all I saw were identical images of trees rising out of the fog at the edge of the water up into mountains whose tops I could not see, and my heart began to pound. And I took a few breaths, and I took my time, and I eventually did find my way back to the marina. But it was a really good and useful lesson for me, just in terms of you all know how steep a tidal swing we can have and how much that can shift your perspective on the shorelines that we have here in this place that we call home. And another occasion, which was much more frightening, was I was out with a buddy. We were hunting up in the Alpine. It was my first time hunting in that way, and he and I became separated. This was a place that he had been before. I had not. And I was really leaning on him because I'm really a novice hunter. But over the short period of time that we were separated and trying to find one another, I was astonished at how little recollection I seemed to have of which direction we had come from and which hills we'd climbed over or around, which little knobs of trees we'd passed through. And it does not take long for that sense of panic or anxiety to take over your mind and start crafting really nightmarish scenarios. And once Chris and I, my friend and I, were reunited and talked about how we would handle a situation like that again in the future, then we could laugh a little bit and talk about all the horrible things that might have happened had things gone astray. And this next and final story for our evening involves a similar story of a couple of guys out for a trip who find themselves in a bit of a hairy predicament. And so I will now turn the microphone over to a recording from Dr. Peter Rice.
Good evening. My name is Peter Rice, and I'm going to tell a story about a trip down the Unic River. This story has rainfall as a key element, so I thought it would be appropriate to our time here, period. I certainly want to thank Jack for organizing Story Slam and these opportunities. This was about 30 years ago, and at the time I had a very good friend who taught me most of what I know about the outdoors and hunting up here, named Roger DeLong, who was certainly an Alaska legend. He's sadly no longer with us. But we started talking about exploring the Unic River, and he was very excited as he had spent quite a bit of time up there running up the river and some down the river, but never on a raft from Canada. So I had recently purchased a 14-foot river raft, and the plan was to take a aluminum boat that I had up to the mouth of the Unic with the raft in it, as well as my older brother Greg, and then be ferried up to Boundary Lake, which is just inside of Canada, by a couple 185s. And this was during the fall, so the idea was to hunt moose on the way down. Well, Boundary Lake was pretty amazing. It is one of the most beautiful lakes I've ever seen. It's surrounded by, of course, huge mountains, glaciers, all the fall colors, and then it had a pretty sizable bright red sockeye run spawning at the time. We spent a couple days there and even saw a bear, but since it was in Canada, that wasn't too helpful. And then we started our trip down the river. The Unic River, I should note, is a pretty high-volume river, and it probably drains many hundreds of square miles of glacier, ultimately, from Canada and some from the United States. It's very silty. I don't think it ever runs clear, although there are a couple side rivers that do. And it is full of log jams and other hazards that make it fairly tricky, and certainly people have drowned there with trying to navigate the log jams. The Unic River was a very important early mining area, and there was a lot of prospecting and many small mines, and as I understand it, there's currently a pretty controversial big mine in Canada that's expansion is being proposed, and it's very controversial because of the robust king salmon run. There's a lot of mining debris up the river still to be seen, and in fact in Boundary Lake there was a remnants of a steam-powered yarder. So we dodged the log jam successfully. I remember one interesting night that we camped was at Old Groner Creek, which was named after a famous bear that, because of previous injuries, apparently groaned loudly much of the time, and he was ultimately shot by a famous pioneer, Bruce Johnstone. There may be some part of the bear in the museum, I think. But we certainly slept with our rifles next to our sleeping bags that night, and then headed down towards the rapids. And we hadn't paid much attention to the rapids flying over, but they're not a terribly long set of rapids, but they looked like they were going to be pretty fun. And what happened was the storms really let loose, and it just poured for, I don't know, 24 hours, and the river level rose 5 feet in one night. So as we approached the rapids, it was evident there was no way to recon them and check them out before we ran them, which is sort of standard practice if you don't know the river. But the water was so high that there was an alternative side river now that was just pouring through the forest. It was the darndest thing I've ever seen. But we decided to take safety over adventure, and we had to just cut one log out of the way and then just sort of sailed through the forest on a raft and out the other side below the rapids. So the rest of the trip was no moose, but easy at that point. And we got to the mouth of the river back in the aluminum boat and started heading on towards town. And we'd only been going, you know, maybe an hour, and I hear this whoop, whoop, whoop sound of a helicopter. And out of the rain and fog appeared the Ketchikan Pulp Company, beautiful white and orange Bell Jet Ranger. And it was piloted by probably the best helicopter pilot of the time, Alan Zink, who's no longer with us. And next to him was Snapper Carson, a friend of mine. And they were both scowling. The helicopter came in slow and quite low. And they were scowling at us and then gave us the finger and hovered there for a minute and then took off towards town. Well, what had happened was they were very worried about us. So we'd been a couple days late. There was no cell phone, no EPIRB, no way to communicate. VHF didn't go back there. So they, I'm sure, were really relieved to see us safe, but I think they'd spent a lot of time searching for us. The final leg, we camped one more night and then made it safely back to Ketchikan. So it was a great adventure. It was made even more adventurous by the incredible heavy rain that we still seem to be getting now and then here in Ketchikan. Thanks very much.
Heavy rain or heavy snow, as the case may be, and I do hope you're gazing out a window, taking in just the beautiful way that the light is playing off the snow. Maybe you caught the sunset this evening, which was really a bit of a stunner. You know, having heard the story again now from Dr. Rice, Peter, thank you so much for sharing that tale, and thanks for the little salutation there at the top of the story. I do appreciate it. But I can't help but think about the conversation those two fellas in the helicopter might have had on their return to town. I wonder if you ever found out how long they had spent looking for you, who had set the alarm, and I wonder, after flipping you that bird, what the nature of their discussions might have been, as, you know, they had at least found the reassurance that you were alive and safe and well, and certainly having a good time, even if you were choosing safety over adventure, which so often is the case here. You really need to play your smartest hand if you find yourself in a bit of a pickle. And that's one thing that I've really loved about revisiting each of these stories tonight. The reason I chose these three and the reason I played them for you in aggregate is because they all touch on different elements of the landscapes and waterscapes that we contend with here, and all from fairly different perspectives, although with that same understanding that as much as we've been able to create and produce and accomplish in this very extraordinary region, this place, it is a humbling and powerful world, natural world that surrounds us. And as we witness today, we are sometimes at its, you know, we have to submit to its will. There's just, I don't know how much snow piled up there, and they're saying that there's more on the way. So I do hope that you are, as I mentioned, warm and snug and safe somewhere. If you're out on the road, do mind the roadways and mind other drivers. There's no hurry to be anywhere. Just get home safe and sound. And thank you for joining us this evening. And if you would like to participate, right now we're working on getting a dedicated email set up at the Arts Council so that there's just one easy email address to remember. But in the meantime, feel free to contact me directly. Again, my name is Jack, and you can email me at cityloveSong@gmail.com. That's cityloveSong@gmail.com. If you have any questions about how to participate, if there's a story that you're wondering if it might fit for the program, if you want to workshop a story, as I mentioned, I'm workshopping a couple of different stories with a couple of storytellers that I hope to have joining us next month. And we do record your stories. Generally, we ask that they be in the 8 to 10 minute range. They can be longer, shorter is fine. If they get much longer than 12 minutes or so, it gets a little trickier here when I'm trying to put a program together. And we have to keep them about PG-13 because this is public radio after all. But again, my email address is cityloveSong@gmail.com. I'd love to hear about stories that you would love to tell, especially if they relate to work that you've done, work that you would love to do, work that you hated doing, any work stories that you might have, especially if they give you some new sense of this place or of yourself for that matter. And in the meantime, I'm going to sign off with my thanks to you and to the Arts Council and KRBD for making this program possible. Have a lovely evening, friends and neighbors, and I will see you next month.